Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, the Federal Reserve. Before I cover the Federal Reserve, I will first finish up the ethics lecture by going through the agency dilemma with you, and then move from there to the Federal Reserve topic. And there is, as I had said, and I'll show these to you, files for both of these topics. The agency dilemma is a PowerPoint presentation, and the Federal Reserve, I have a Word document that contains some links to resources that might be of use to you in learning about the Federal Reserve. But before we do that, let's look at the numbers. And as you might be able to see, it was really nothing day. You had the Dow barely ticking up 10.10%. And then you had the S&P 500 up a little more than a third of a percent. And then the NASDAQ had a little bit of a run up there really nothing spectacular that wasn't too bad, about 0.6%. But it was not a major wild day on the street. The interesting thing is that, as you can see, the VIX, the volatility measure that I look at, it was down. Everyone is being very calm, and it's a very much a wait and see attitude right now. Even the gold traders are just sitting, kind of waiting for the next piece of information to come out that will tell them what to do. But across the world, the Nikkei just had a little tiny bit of a down day, nothing spectacular, and the Hang Seng. I thought the Hang Seng was down. Yeah, it is down. Down a little bit. Nothing spectacular, just a little bit of more bearish than bullish sentiment. And over on in Europe, the same was true in the European, that index there. And how is CAC doing? Yeah, I didn't watch that too much. It was down just a little bit. And the FTSE, now this is the third day it's done this odd thing. The London Exchange, it was going kind of up and down, and then at the end, it just dropped, did a very serious sell-off, and I'm not sure what that is. At the end of every trading day, the bears are coming in and doing some profit-taking, and I just can't quite figure out what that's all about. Now, here's on the other on the asset side, you've got gold is trying to push up a little bit, but it seems to still be comfortable around the 4,000, 4,100 mark. And again, it's a wait and see game. It still may have a good strong surge later, and that the first big marker that's going to tell us where things are going is, as I mentioned before, the sales figures from Black Friday, which is coming in just about a week and a half or so. We will see how Black Friday plays out. Are people out there buying lots of stuff? If so, well, you're probably going to see the market surge. If the numbers are disappointing, then you're going to start to see more bear days than bull days ahead. And of course, oil just can't seem to find any reason to live anymore. It's down below $60 a barrel. That's going to be the way it is for many months to come. And most likely, the OPEC plus countries will shut off the oil supply, really reduce it, I should say, after the elections next November. They are not going to do anything to stir up election issues. You're playing with the elections. They'll just let it be where it is. And then after those elections, they're going to start reducing the supply of oil. That'll drive the price of oil way up, and we'll have higher gasoline prices. But that's not for a while yet. So you don't need to hurry up and buy your oil. Now, I want to show you over here the 10-year bond. It had made it below 4%. good news, because lower interest rates are going to stimulate economic activity. You saw when we did net present values, as you lower the discount rate, the net present value of projects becomes more higher. And so you'll get more projects being accepted. And that means more projects, more orders of big things for the projects, more jobs. This is all good news. Interest rates going down. However, they came back up above 4%, and they're holding stubbornly in about the 4.10 to 4.15% range. So they're not going to be stimulating economic activity that we desperately want to have. They're just going to just sit there being a little stubborn about it and not giving us any extra fuel for the economic expansion. Now, if you look at the sector map, interestingly, there are more green sectors than red sectors. So the market was overall kind of bullish today, even though the numbers don't look very bullish. Overall, by the sector map, you've got more greens than red, and technology, which had gone into the red a couple of days in a row, is back in the green. In other words, technology stocks are going up in price. The bulls are giving favor to those kinds of stocks. Now, let me get down to lectures today. I'll start by showing you in your Canvas files folders, there are two. One is for the ethics lecture. This is on agency, which I'm going to cover for the first 30 minutes or so of the lecture today. You go here to files, and you look here in the top file drawer, you will see agency.pptx. Download it. It's something a little more in depth than what I do in the classroom. Now, there will be only one thing that's in the PowerPoints that I don't cover in lecture today, and that's simply because I want you to look at the PowerPoint presentation and find that information there. But I'll tell you what it is to find. Now, the other thing is a little bit awkward here. I'm going to talk about the Federal Reserve. Now, if you click on the Federal Reserve folder, there is a document in there. That document has a couple of web links in it. And if I download that, you will see. Well, that sucks. Oh, I see. Okay. Now, the first one is just a document about how the Federal Reserve works. It's a very in-depth version of my lecture. Now, what is in my lecture is what I would hold you to for a final exam or a final quiz. So this takes you deeper into it than I go in the lecture, but it's worth it for you to look at. Now, this one, I'm going to have to replace this link because this was a link to a government video. It's a silly, cartoonish video from decades ago, but it is so popular. It's done in junior high, in high schools, community colleges, universities. We all like to assign this 15-minute cartoon video, which does an amazingly good job of summarizing the Federal Reserve System. And but the government canceled this video for one reason or another. However, it is on YouTube, and I'll just put up the YouTube link to the video. I was actually blindsided by this in the first class. You think that's going to be there forever? No, this one they tore down apparently for political reasons. But anyway, well, I'll put it back up. It's still on YouTube. And it's just lightweight, watch it, and you'll see how it coordinates with my lecture on the Federal Reserve System. But let me start with the last part of the lecture on ethics. Before I do that, why don't you just log into your, mark your attendance right now and in attendance radar. That way I won't forget it. I almost said that's all for you today. I thank you. And then I realized I hadn't taken attendance, so this time I'm going to do it right. Okay. Now this first little bit of information I have covered a little bit before, and I will be a little bit deeper in it this time. You had a course, a law course, FIL 185, and it's a summary of business law. And I'm going to dig in a little deeper than that course in one area. And it has to do with two kinds of law. Now, both of these laws are operating in the United States, as they do in Great Britain, because the older law is still in play. But a different kind of law is also in play because of an invasion that happened in 1066, AD 1066. But here's statutory law is one kind of law, and the other kind of law is common law. Statutory law is law that is written down, statutes, in a book. We got the monumental version of this was the Roman Empire, which had Lex Romana, the law of the Romans, and it was bigger and bigger and bigger all the time because new laws were passed and they were written down, thou shalt not, thou shalt, and all that. Everything was written in a book. And it got to the point where it was insanely overburdensome, but it was so comprehensive that even when the Roman Empire finally came to a pretty much an end in AD 476 with the last invasion of the Visigoths didn't throw out Roman law. They just stopped calling it Lex Romana and they called it Lex Romana Visigoth. And so there you are. And it still was around. And all of the places in the Roman Empire that had been occupied or influenced by the Roman Empire carried the same kind of law, statutory law. Spain, France, Italy, those kinds of places. They all are statutory law countries to this day. But then there's the other kind of law, the law that we call the law of the tribes, the law of all tribes, common law. This law is not written down. Books are written about it. It is oral law, passed down from generation to generation. Decisions are made, and then those carry through the generations. And there's even a term, oddly, in Latin called stare decisis, which means look to the past decision for your guidance on how to decide on some matter of law in the present. This is how our Supreme Court works. It works on the idea of precedence. A previous Supreme Court had made a decision, and so a current Supreme Court is very unlikely, or at least it should be unlikely, to go against that previous decision. Most of your law training, if you ever took law classes, is knowing what has already been decided and putting that before a court and saying, this is how it was decided, please decide it that way for us. Okay. Common law. Interestingly enough, a lot of business law, there's a lot of it that's statutory, that creates regulations and all that. But underlying that is this common law. One place where common law plays out is in torts, T-O-R-T-S. Those are wrongs against another. Civil wrongs against another. This is civil law. So you could have a tort of defamation, a tort of assault, a tort of battery, or a tort of another kind. And then you also, in common law, surprising to some, is a contract law. It's primarily common law. Contracts have been carried down through literally thousands of years, the understandings of bindings among peoples and among groups. Contract law is ancient law. It's not written law. It is not statutory law. It is common law. But it is every bit as powerful as a statutory law, especially because of its ancient nature. So I set this up like this because we are going to talk about something that is primarily common law, and it has to do with the workings of corporations. And it touches into that thing that we talked about in the last lecture, which was ethics. Ethics, as I tried to leave it with you in the last one, was kind of a mishmash. Well, you had the categorical imperative. Then you had situational ethics, and you could have strict situational ethics or loose situational ethics. Where do we get our guidance, especially in our business lives? How do we decide how to conduct ourselves in the business world? What is there a way? Well, that might be answered by, first of all, explaining agency. There are two players in agency. There is the agent, and then there is the principal. Now, the agent is the person charged with maximizing the welfare, with maximizing the welfare of the principal. The agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of the principal. The principal is the person whose welfare is to be maximized by the agent. Maximized by the agent. Okay, here we go. Now, there's a word in here that I must address. This word, person. A person in the law is not necessarily an individual, a human. A person in law is any entity that is legally identifiable. So a person could be you, but a person could be this class, maybe, I don't know. A person could be a corporation. A person could be the shareholders. A person could be the board of directors. Now notice that when I'm talking about this, these are not individuals. The individual board of directors are not the person. It is the entity that is the board. The shareholders, is not any particular shareholder. It is all of the shareholders taken together as a single entity. A contract can establish a person, an entity recognized under the law. Here's the problem that has come up. Since the 1970s, I think it is probably, courts have been recognizing that word person as being useful in interpreting constitutional matters. So free speech, which used to be restricted to people, individuals, is being recognized now as applying to the person of a corporation. This culminated in an absolutely catastrophic decision in 2010, where the Supreme Court said that a corporation is a person. Persons in the Constitution have free speech, so corporations have free speech. The applicable issue there is that corporations can give as much money as they want to political candidates. They can give as much as they want to political action committees because it's free speech, and persons are allowed free speech under our Constitution. You see how that person actually can be a slippery slope. For our purposes, it is very tight. It is some entity that is identifiable within a contractual relationship. Now, remember that contracts can be oral or written. They don't have to be written. Oral contracts are perfectly valid. They're the most frequent, by far, kinds of contracts that exist. But there has to be a contract involved. So I want to stick this close to contractual entities. Okay. Now, the agent, that is someone or something that is charged with maximizing the welfare of another. That other is the principal. So, for example, I am your doctor. You can get another one. It's just a healthcare system. Okay, I'm your doctor. You're my patient. I am the agent. You are the principal. Because my job is to maximize your health. You see that? Okay, so it's clearly an agency relationship. I am your lawyer. That would mean that you are the principal, I am the agent. My job is to maximize your freedom. Okay, or something like, bad woman, bad. Okay. Understand that this is an important part of this. Let's try one here that might be kind of interesting to play. Sir, you are my child. Look, I was lonely, okay? And it was a truck stop. Okay, here we go. Who is the agent and who is the principal in our relationship?
Would I be the principal?
Yes, you are. Because it's my job to maximize your welfare. You are the principal in a parent-child agency relationship. Well, I never signed up for this. Well, that's where we get into the common law of in fact. In fact, you are. Not necessarily in law. Well, there are laws about it. But you are the principal in fact, just by virtue of it being a parent-child relationship. Here's one. Here's a good one. Let me think about this for a second. Sir, you are married. There's a husband and there's a wife, and they're married. Okay, who is the agent and who is the principal? And I caution you to be careful in how you speak here. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a marriage?
No idea.
Huh?
I don't know.
Okay, who's the agent and who's the principal? Be careful. Who's the boss? I ain't gonna say. I know, right? Here's the thing. Neither. The marriage is the principal. It isn't just a contract, but it is a principal. Both the husband and the wife are charged with maximizing the welfare of the marriage. So the husband and wife are both the agents. The marriage contract is the principal. It's a person. That marriage is a person under the law. There's a contract and all that, the marriage certificate, the license and all that kind of stuff. There is a contract, and this gives you the clear indication that a principal, actually even an agent, doesn't necessarily have to be a living thing at all. Plays out in many different situations. In fact, as a soldier, I swore an oath to the Constitution to protect and defend the nation against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. The Constitution is just a piece of paper. The only life it has is through the dutiful actions of its agents, the citizens, the soldiers. That is the only way it has any life. That marriage means nothing if the husband and wife both do not seek to maximize its welfare. The Constitution has no meaning unless we are willing to defend and participate in the life of the nation. So I'm emphasizing here that you don't have to have a person in the sense of an individual being a principal or an agent. Now here's an important idea right here that that takes us into an important word. Okay. When there is an agency relationship, it is the principal who is responsible for the behavior. We say that the principal has vicarious liability. For the actions of the agents. In other words, the term we use is that the principal is the respondeat superior. Respondeat superior. Whatever the agent does, you can't say, well, you can't hold me responsible because that was this person who works for me. Wrong. It rises to the top. No matter how hard you would try to get out from under liability for an action, if you're the principal, you own it. That's why corporations, before they hire you, they are going to go into whatever it is they can find about you, because they know that your actions are going to impact on them once you are hired. So in other words, they're going to look at your social media. They're going to, if you're holding a drink, don't ever let anyone photograph you holding a drink. Bad stuff. We even have to do that at some of our 21 and 22-year-olds at some of the events we take them to. Say, put the drink down. Oh, you over there with that camera, put it the F down until we have everyone get their drinks out of their hands, things like that. You write crazy posts on some social media platform. Most corporations don't want that aggravation of employees who can reflect on the company adversely, especially if there could be legal consequences to it. This is why corporations tend to be quite conservative in how their employees behave. Okay. However, there's one exception to this. There's one place, one set of circumstances where the principal is not the respondeat superior. There are relationships where the principal, remember the one with the child and the parent? You're the principal. You're the one who's responsible for making sure everything goes cool, right? But you can't. You're just a kid. You don't know what's right and what's wrong. So in that relationship, there's a permanent defect in your ability to monitor and enforce compliance with the agency relationship. With the doctor relation and patient relationship, in this case, You're not trained in medicine. I'm the agent, but you're not trained in medicine, but you're responsible for what I do. How could you be if you're under anesthetic, for example? You can't monitor and enforce my behavior. For all you know, when you go to sleep, I could pull out your lower bowel and say, watch this. Doom, 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 doom. You can't do it. There's a fundamental defect. In the legal issue, you're not trained in law. You're not even allowed to practice in a courtroom unless you can convince a court that you're going to operate pro se. So you're not even allowed to, even though you're the principal, you're not allowed to be in front of that court. So this gives you an idea that there's something that's going on in these special kinds of agency relationships. We call it fiduciary. A fiduciary relationship is where the agent is actually responsible. Accountants and financial advisors have fiduciary duty because our clients, they don't know accounting, they don't know investments, they can't know what we know. They don't have access to the training and the education and the licensing and the communications with market participants. They can't do it. So we have accountants and financial analysts, financial investment advisors. We have a fiduciary duty. Now, let me say this. Black's Law Dictionary defines fiduciary duty as the highest duty implied by law. Now, there are two words in here that are very important to this. Highest. There is no higher duty. So if you are a fiduciary in two different situations at the same time, you can't prioritize them. Well, I know they're both fiduciary, but I'll make this one the highest and this one a little lower. No, they're both highest. So if you have a marriage and you have a fiduciary duty to a corporation, you cannot prioritize those because they are both the highest duty. Now, the other part of this is implied. That's common law. This is an understanding that goes back into the echoes of time, 5,000 years. We see it in the languages that came out of the tribes around the Black Sea, what we call the Indo-European languages, in everything from Latin to Greek to French to English to German, all the Germanic languages, even to India. These languages all carry these curious words that sound similar. Lex, logo, ligature, line, bindings of people in relationships. We know how old this is. The medieval knights, they were fiduciaries of the king because the king could not defend the empire on his or her own. So this is an ancient term, and it echoes to this day. And one of the things that I notice is that in a lot of classes and a lot of my graduates, they have never even heard of fiduciary duty, fiduciary relationship. And yet, this is one of the binders of our civilization, when agents must act like principals because the principals cannot do what the agents can do. So that sets us up. Now, there are three hallmarks of fiduciary duty. And what I'm going to do is tell you that they are in the PowerPoint presentation, and I will hold you to them on the final exam. And that encourages you to at least skim through that agency PowerPoint to find those. I'll even give you a hint. One of them is trust. Okay, now take that off the board. Let's get back to agency in the typical agency relationships. Who am I? Madam, you are driving down this beautiful country road on a bright sunny day. Smooth road, as far as the eye can see, cornfields on both sides of you, and you see a speed limit sign 55 miles an hour. You drive by it and you say, lol. So you press the gas pedal to 70, 80, 90. At some point, you see the stars streaking by you, and you hear a voice say, warp 6. But then far out up the road, in one of those drives that goes into a field, you see a car. And then you get closer. OMG, that's a sheriff's deputy's car. What are you going to do?
Stop.
Well, not stop. You'll slow down, right? You ever notice on the highway, it's a nice clear highway, but all up ahead you suddenly see a bunch of brake lights come on? That's the people finding Jesus, and he's in a state highway patrol car about to nail you. People tend to behave themselves suddenly. In contracts, the worthiness or worthfulness of a contract must have monitoring provisions. Compliance must have monitoring. You have to be able to watch. Now, the other thing, though, what happens if you get close enough to that sheriff's deputy car? You see him outside the car, and he's changing the flat tire. Now, are you going to still go slow? I wouldn't. I wave on high and keep going. So there we have the second pillar of a worthwhile contract, enforcement. And both of these must be in place. If you can monitor but you can't enforce, what do you have? Nothing. If you can enforce but you can't monitor, you got nothing. You can't see. Oh, you can have all the rules in the world in your workplace, but if you can't watch for the compliance, why even have the contract? Just let them do whatever they feel like doing. Now, let me go to the next step in this. I'm getting close to showing the agency dilemma. Here's the problem. We got an agency relationship. The truth of the matter is that every agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of that of the principal. Every agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of the welfare of the principal. This is not a cynical view of the world. It is the reality. You may believe, I may think, you're my agent, and I may think very much of you. You're my friend. We've known each other for a long time. But I still know that you have incentive to take from me for yourself instead of maximizing my welfare. First rule of warfare, never assume another's intentions, only his capabilities. We have to abide by that in our relationships, especially in corporations. I don't care what they intend to do, what I think they will do, what they tell me they will do. I will still monitor and enforce the contract I have with them. That's the only way I can be certain that that agent will act in my behalf. Think about it this way. Well, the parent-child relationship. Okay, I'm the agent of the child. I'm your agent. Well, and your agent. You're all, I come home some night And there you are just tearing up the house, bouncing off the furniture. You're hanging from the chandelier. I don't even know what you're doing. You're trying to put the cat in the oven, for God's sake. Of what I am supposed to do as the principal is take all of you. Come on, sweeties. Come on. Let's all get down here. Yeah, I'm going to fix you a nutritious meal. You know, and I'll make it from scratch. And then I'll read you some bookies and then give you nice baths and then put you to tuck you to bed. And we'll say our prayers together. Oh, I love you so much. I'm your agent. You're my principal. That's not what you're going to do. You come home from work. You're dead tired. You're tearing up the house, breaking things, and I'm going to just sit down. Oh, got it. You, quit it. Stop that. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself with it. Oh, yes, you will. No, you won't. I would. But the thing, though, is that you understand that what you're supposed to do and what you really will do as an agent are two different things. This is just the reality of life. No matter what your religious affiliation is, no matter what your ethical standards are, you have incentive to violate the agency relationship as the agent. And so here's the thing. In finance especially, but in any business subject, we want to talk about liquidated cost. What is the cost of this agency dilemma? What is the cost of this agency dilemma? Well, we break it into five parts, five different costs. The first of these costs, the first of the agency costs is perquisites. And I'm aiming this at businesses, talking about businesses. Perquisites, what we call perks. These are benefits an agent extracts by virtue of position. Benefits the agent extracts by virtue of position. Benefits the agent extracts by virtue of position. The CEO who has a desk the size of a landing strip on an aircraft carrier. The C-suite executives who take a private jet for their meetings. And then they stay in five-star hotels and eat at five-star restaurants. Those are perks. That is money that belonged to the shareholders, and they are taking it. In other words, the principals. The shareholders are the principals. And yet you have these agents of the principal who are going to take more than they deserve because of their position. Think about it in terms of Tesla. The board of directors handed Elon Musk a $1 trillion package. That belongs to the shareholders. Well, Elon's a shareholder. No, it belongs to the shareholders as a block. Not to one, to all of them. Perks are everywhere in corporate America and corporate Europe, corporate everywhere, really. Taking more than you need to do your job. When you're paying people's executives insane salaries to do what could be done by people who want less, you're taking from the shareholders who, in other words, you're paying them that executive salary, that's in operating expenses, that goes down to operating income, subtracts to make operating income, gets down there to net income, gets down to NOPAT, gets down to free cash flow. In other words, this is the residual claim the shareholders were supposed to get, they don't get because of the perks. The next one is shirking. Shirking is avoiding agency duties. Shirking is avoiding your agency duties. The extra 5 minutes for your smoke break. Come skidding into the office 10 minutes late. Or coming back from lunch 10 minutes late. Hanging out around the other people's cubicles talking about how great your weekend was. Those are shirking your duties. And I probably mentioned this one, but I was at a dinner some years ago, not that many years ago. One of the account executives at the table, he was bragging about, my desk is always clear when I leave at night. It's I do everything, then I can go home and just relax. And then he got a little tipsy and he was yakking at the other end of the table. And one of the administrative assistants said, yeah, that's because every night he takes the work on his desk and he just walks around his subordinates' desks and puts it on their desks. That's shirking. That's classic shirking. And then they come in the morning thinking that their desks were clear because of all they've done, and there's a pile of work that he's handed off to them. Another example, one of my favorites, is years and years ago, I did a consulting job for a corporation, and every morning there was one account executive who came in exactly at 8 o'clock. It was perfect. And he'd go right past the receptionist's desk, grab the Wall Street Journal off her stand, and then he'd go into the executive bathroom, and he'd stay there for 40 minutes. 40 minutes every morning. That man was absolutely incredible in how regular his bowel movements were. Every day he did this. And then he'd come out whistling and fold up the paper and put it back on the receptionist's desk, and she'd pick it up like this and throw it away. But yeah, that's shirking, classic shirking. And you can think of all kinds of other examples. And I could think of some, and I don't want to stir up trouble with professors, but the one who lets classes go 30 minutes early. Well, we've only got 2 hours left, so why don't we quit for the day? All kinds of ways that you can shirk your responsibilities as an agent. I could shirk my responsibilities by not walking around and keeping an eye on you as you are doing your quizzes. It's easy for me to do it, but that's shirking my duty, which is to maximize the welfare of my principle. And my principle is Western civilization. It's not even here. It's a thing, a person, that needs me to produce people who will keep Western civilization alive, at least until I'm dead. Okay, the third one is theft, direct theft, just stealing. Paper clips in an office environment. I got myself an extra sticky note pad. It was yellow. It was cool. Shirking in retail, just taking something home. Meat packing plants where there is a loss that is attributable to people. I worked a consulting job for a slaughterhouse. Years ago, and there was even a joke. Every night, you would have the employees who cut the meats on the cutting floors and all of that kind of stuff. They left a lot fatter than they came in, holding, tying a chuck roast around the waist and stuff like that. So, yeah. And, of course, monitoring and enforcement is a problem. How much does it cost to monitor them? What would it cost to enforce? Are you going to arrest them? Yeah, that's not going to happen because you are not a law enforcement agency. Your security guards can't do as much as you think they can. You buy a whole bunch of cameras to watch them at all times. How much is that going to cost for that system? How much is it going to cost for someone to watch it at all times of the day and night? You see, monitoring enforcement has its limits, but direct theft is a real, real issue. Another one. Have you ever worked with someone who was as dumb as a box of rocks? And that was disrespecting rocks, really. Incompetence. Incompetence is actually a management principle. It's called the Peter Principle. Everyone in an organization will rise to his or her level of incompetence. You, sir, were great when I hired you as just a data entry operator. So, obviously, in a meritocracy, I'm going to give you a promotion. You're still great in that job. I'm going to promote you. until I promote you to a place you can't, something you can't do. And then you're going to stay there. The Peter Principle states that every worker rises to his or her level of incompetence and then levels out there and stays. And we can see it every day when you walk into any corporate environment. Look at everyone around you. Look in the mirror. And you will know pretty certainly that everyone there is rising or has risen to his or her level of incompetence. We see this in sports quite a bit. Coaches who were great as assistant coaches, and eventually they got a position at the top and they suck as a head coach. We see it in corporations. Workers who rose until they were in the executive suite, and then they are just not capable of doing the work, and they stay there at that level. So incompetence is a huge issue, and you always have to be on the lookout for it. And that's why in some cultures, corporate culture is to, instead of moving people vertically, they move them horizontally from one department, one platform to another. And they say you have to be good in all of these before we will be able to trust you to rise in the ranks of the corporation. And that's very much the way some corporations, even here in the United States, are embracing that idea of broadly exposing their employees to the operations of the whole company, but more importantly, informing the management of the capability of these people to be competent enough to rise a level. Now, the last one is lying. And the truth of the matter is that everyone lies. But in the corporate environment, we must be vigilant. Tell you a story, kind of a bragging story I heard, and I heard it from someone who wasn't one of the two involved. A head of a division of a company had there was a board meeting about a week from then, and she had the month before charged one of her subordinates with preparing the PowerPoint presentation for the board meeting. And about a week before, she just went over and asked him, how are you doing with that PowerPoint presentation? And he told her, I'm almost finished with it. The next thing she said was, show me. And of course, he hadn't started it, and she fired him right on the spot. Now that's vicious, but that is enforcement. She monitored and enforced, and was that ethical? Ethics doesn't come into it there. He screwed up, and that was the end of him there. The same thing is true in a lot of situations where you're in basic training or in more advanced training. Anything you say, they're going to check, and if you lied, they just beat the shit out of you. That's just the reality of it. They don't do that now. They just speak harshly to you these days. But the underlying issue is that in order to gain compliance, to behave according to what the corporation wants, there must be monitoring and enforcement. Recognizing, though, that that is a cost in itself. So there has to be a balance. Now, if we would embrace something like stakeholder theory, the corporation itself is an agent of a much larger entity called the society, possibly an entity called the earth itself. And it cannot monitor and enforce us. The community cannot monitor and enforce our behavior as a corporation. So that means that in the case of something that is larger than the corporation, the corporation must face the fact that its relationship with the world around it is fiduciary. And that replaces talking about ethics and brings it down to our responsibility is to take care of the world like a parent takes care of a child. Because in both cases, the principal cannot take care of itself. So it is left to us to do that. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.